The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. London is red. I mean, it isn't, but that's what the young people say as Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang leads Arsenal to the FA Cup. A tactical masterclass from Arteta over Lampard, or the result of a pinged Pulisic hamstring, and a why can't VAR check yellow cards, yellow card for Kovacic. Also, the end of Eddie and how. Well, mutual consent is how. We'll assess his achievements at Bournemouth. Elsewhere, hashtag empty cans, no Saudi takeover for Newcastle. Was it ever going to happen? And despite some protestations, have the Geordies dodged a bullet. There's Fitbar Corner Deluxe as the SPFL begins. Ewan Murray joins us from the future. And we have Harrogate Mythbusters with Jonathan Wilson. We preview the Championship playoff final and will almost certainly not spend enough time discussing Wes Houlihan to Cambridge United. All that plus your questions. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Jonathan Wilson, good morning.
Morning.
Out for a duck this weekend, didn't bowl. That's when village cricket's at its best, isn't it?
Took a catch, though. Took a catch. It was a good ball, you know. You kind of, when you open the batting, you have to accept that sometimes you just get a good nut.
Absolutely right. Good morning, Philippe Auclair.
Good morning to you, Max. I was not out this weekend, but it's only because I didn't play.
Barry Glendenning, were you out this weekend? Were you out?
I wasn't out. I haven't been out in a very, very, very long time. But I was out with a small O.
Okay. I reckon out with a small O means something very different to you than it does to me, but who knows? because we see far too much of each other, we don't want to go out with each other at any time. So then, Arsenal 2, Chelsea 1, Arsenal's 14th FA Cup win, 2 more than anyone else. Man United have 12. Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang, how delightful, Philippe, was that winning goal?
Absolutely delightful, Max, and not exactly typical either of the way that Aubameyang usually finishes these kind of moves. It's more a Thierry Henry normally, like with the inside of the right boot, and an unexpected goal as well, because Hector Bellerin came from midfield, like running through all of that Chelsea midfield like butter, perhaps committing a foul. Did he commit a foul?
Oh, do you think so? I didn't spot that. I love Bellerin's such a nice, great human being that I would forgive him anything on a pitch.
Did you see what he did with his FA Cup medal afterwards, by the way?
Oh, no. What did he do?
He made it into an earring and was wearing it.
Oh, well, is that quite 1980s? I mean, how big is an FA Cup final winner's
medal? Well, it's rather large. I mean, it looked like a solid thing on his left ear.
I mean, eventually it would weigh heavy on the lobe, I think.
I don't think he would keep it for very long. Yes, it would distend the lobe to a great degree.
And we don't need Bellerin's distended lobe. It's not what anybody needs, isn't it? But listen, Philippe, he's such a tremendous player. He's so
That sounds a bit like the name for a stupid quiz team, doesn't it?
He does. He's such a pivotal player for Arsenal, isn't he, Aubameyang? And so much has been said after this game about whether he's going to stay or not. But I don't know if we should just celebrate how good he's been for them.
He's been absolutely tremendous. And I think perhaps to an extent that we were not expecting. Because of where he'd been successful before, when you say when he was with Saint-Etienne in Ligue 1, he was not against the same calibre of opposition. When he was with Borussia Dortmund, he was with a far more functional kind of team than this Arsenal side has been. And he's been asked to fulfil very different roles at Arsenal, where he's been playing on the left a lot of the time. He's been playing in the centre sometimes. And also perhaps people were not expecting for him to take to the captaincy as he did. But, you know, he's shown admirable, just talent in finishing, but also commitment to the cause. And yes, he's got to be the one that Arsenal's plans must be based around the future. But it looks all right, doesn't it? I mean, the noise we heard about from Mikel Arteta afterwards were quite encouraging from an Arsenal point of view, of course.
85 games, 55 goals, 12 assists.
Yeah.
Won the last year's Golden Boot. He's got 0.64 goals per game, which is comparable with Harry Kane's 0.68. Since making his debut for Arsenal in February 2018, has scored more goals in all competitions than any other Premier League player, 69. One more than Mo Salah. Baz, did you expect an Arsenal victory?
I wouldn't say I expected an Arsenal victory. I wasn't surprised. I thought it would be pretty close. I thought it might actually go to extra time and end up being decided by penalties, maybe, but yeah, I wouldn't say I was. I think Chelsea were narrow favourites or slight favourites going into it, but it's a game that probably could have gone either way. Chelsea started very well and then sort of down tools after the first water break, 23 minutes or whatever, and then Arsenal took control of the game and went on to win it. I thought they deserved to win it. Chelsea were a little bit unlucky with the injuries. Second yellow card for Kovacic, I thought, shouldn't have been a yellow card. I think everyone seems to agree on that. But they didn't play well enough to win it, I don't think. But it could be argued that circumstances conspired against them.
Mikel Arteta is the first Arsenal manager to win a major trophy in their first season in charge of the club since George Graham in 86-87. Mm. The first person to win the FA Cup with Arsenal and as a player and a manager. Barney writing, if Arteta has shown one outstanding quality, it's his ability to organise his team for one-off games against high-class opponents to instil an intensity and attention to detail that has for many years been a defining Arsenal absence. Would you go along with that, Jonathan?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think from an Arsenal point of view, the first sort of 6 months or so of his reign have been highly encouraging. That there is a sense they have a plan now. There's a sense they have they know exactly what they're doing. There's obviously a problem with sustaining that over a protracted period with a squad that does have deficiencies in certain areas. But I thought the way they isolated that, the Aspilicueta, Reece James, relationship, Chelsea had no answer to that. And Aspilicueta's lack of pace was exposed again and again by simple balls, just popped over the top of them. And they countered that when they had to, and Aspilicueta went off by moving Kurt Zouma over there, and Aubameyang was notably less effective after that had happened. But still, the disorganisation elsewhere in Chelsea undid them. And all this talk about Chelsea being unlucky, with the injuries, clearly that is true. But the Kovacic sending off, okay, that shouldn't have been a sending off, but Aspilicueta should have been sent off. It's the most obvious red card you'll ever see. And this is the explanation that was apparently given by the fourth official to Arteta, was it was a genuine attempt to play the ball. Wait, I mean, how do you win the ball by grabbing somebody's shoulder? That's nonsense. It's just a blatant red card that wasn't given.
That's the actual explanation, because at the time people thought it was because Antonio Rudiger was in a position where perhaps he would have been able to, deal with the danger.
Yeah, that's what I thought was for, which I think was also wrong, because that ball was in Aubameyang's stride. So basically he's going to put his right foot down, and then as he came through, he was going to hit with his left foot. Rudiger's still 12 yards away. There's no way that Rudiger's going to get across to him. So that is a clear denial of a goal-scoring opportunity. It's in the box. So had it been a genuine attempt to play the ball under the new law, it's a yellow card. But that's not a genuine attempt to play the ball. But at half-time, Dan Walker said that he'd heard Arteta ask the fourth official why it hadn't been a red card. And the fourth official had said, because Anthony Taylor deemed it a genuine attempt to play the ball, which I think actually one of the least forgivable decisions I've ever seen on a football pitch, in that I can understand why he got the coverage decision wrong. Your two legs hit each other. It can be quite hard to tell who initiated it, how hard it was, what the level of intent was, particularly when you have, it was Xhaka, wasn't it? Xhaka going down screaming. But I cannot see how you think that's a genuine attempt to play the ball. And so I think he's made a mistake in law, not in fact. And I remember a book I had in the 80s with the umpire Barry Duddleston, in which he said players will forgive you errors of fact but not of law. And I think that's absolutely true, and I think that's an error of law. And I think Andy Taylor had a disgracefully bad day, and I think that is the worst of the decisions. And I wonder if the way the decisions then seemed to go against Chelsea after that were him knowing that and subconsciously trying to make up for it.
Jonathan, I know you don't like to talk about this kind of thing, but that space between Aspilicueta and Reece James, would you say that is a tactical failing of Lampard to not fix that as soon as it was sort of pretty obvious to everyone else?
What, you mean the first weekend of the season? Yeah. I mean, seriously, when have you ever seen... I mean, Philippe's saying he's never seen Hector Bellerin make a run like that. When have you ever seen any player make a run like that? You can't. It just doesn't happen in modern football. It might happen in the last 10 minutes when one team's knackered and chasing the game. But the idea is somebody can run unchallenged for 40 yards in the middle of a pitch, in the middle of a game, in what year are we in? 2020? it's preposterously bad.
But hang on, that Bellerin run, is that tactical failing of Lampard or just his players not doing the right things?
Well, those two things are related, you'd hope. And if they're not related, why bother having a coach at all?
You would imagine the fact that we had such a, you know, a seesawing final was also due to the fact that nobody really could quite control the midfield. There were loads of spaces to be. You could actually go bang down the middle. I was thinking, actually, Christian Pulisic against Manchester City, perhaps, Jonathan. But that was on a swifter counter, and you could say it was a question of
pace. This is the point. It's not really a counter. Okay, there's a turnover of possession, but you know, he's literally got 40 yards to run before he hits the first defender in the middle of the pitch.
Hang on, in the goal of the season, Heung-min Son ran past at least 72 Burnley players this season.
Yes, he ran past players.
Okay,
what I'm saying is there were no players, and so Rudiger is in this awful position. Where he's got a choice of either dropping off and letting Bellerin come, and then he's got to, you know, probably going to make a foul on the edge of the box. Or he tries to intercept him high up the pitch so that if he commits a foul, at least it's sort of 40, 50 yards from goal. But what he must have been hoping was that either Christensen or Marcus Alonso tucked in behind him, and neither of them did. But there should have been somebody in front of Rudiger to stop him being that exposed. And that, you know, that's a failing that's been there all season. So, you know, both goals came from Chelsea not being able to deal with defensive transition.
Question from Jim. How much does Philippe love Kieran Tierney?
How much do I love him?
Mm-hmm.
A great deal. Is that enough for you? No, he's been, again, one of the great satisfactions of the tail end of the season. And to see him playing that role as well. Which is slightly unusual, but again, Jonathan was talking about relationships, like between Cesar Azpilicueta and Reece, and here we have a proper relationship which has been established between Kieran Tierney as a kind of left side central defender, and Maitland-Niles, and you've got a combination of pace and also great accuracy in the passing. But I mean, I have to say what he's showing at the moment, and which he showed glimpses of with Arsenal before the injuries. Particularly in the Europa League, is exactly what the people who've been following him with Celtic have been telling me from the beginning. He's that kind of player. Wonderful quality of delivery of the ball, and you know, is a proper acquisition for Arsenal. There was one thing, you know, because we're talking about the failings about Chelsea, and you could talk about the failings of Arsenal as well, you know, on Pulisic's goal. But the one thing that I thought was quite remarkable. So after going down to that early goal by Pulisic, you would have expected, of course, this Arsenal side to become a little bit tentative, at least. And the most striking thing was the way they were playing from the back, and which is quite extraordinary, because they've been trying to play from the back under Unai Emery. It was a disaster. They tried to play from the back under Arteta from the beginning, and it didn't always work, to say the least. And there was a confidence in doing something which had brought them a lot of trouble in the past few months, which was quite remarkable, especially when you've been on the receiving end of an opening goal. It shows just the transformation of both the psychological transformation of the side, the confidence they have in their means to apply this kind of approach to the game, and actually the technical quality of that side, because some of the way they worked the ball upfield was quite remarkable. And that, I think, yeah.
But I think it's also organisational, though, right? There are now passing options. They're passing at the right time. All those things have got to build together. So you know, I think you've got to give Arteta credit for that as well.
And it's been said on this podcast before, I can't remember by whom, but that it's helpful for them that they're playing behind closed doors, because Arsenal fans are famously impatient and might not have any truck with that kind of stuff if it's not working, this fancy Dan passing out from the back. If the crowd isn't there, they can't get on the players' back, so the players are probably more confident about trying it, and the more they try it, the better they get at it. So that's been a benefit of playing behind closed doors for Arsenal, I suspect.
Ryan says, can we talk about Christian Pulisic's hamstring as Philippe Auclair plays a sad ballad in the background? How much will this set the US men's national team back? Answer, about 2 years. He's expected to miss Saturday's Champions League tie against Bayern. I mean, I was saying to you on the radio yesterday, Barry, for your hamstring to go and then you to take three more steps and get a shot away is kind of superhuman. And it kind of, I don't know if any of your my hamstring has gone when stretching for a ball, and you collapse like those little toys, you know, that have string all up them, and you press the bottom of them and they just collapse, or like a weevil or whatever it is. Is it a weeble or a weevil? One is a small animal and one is a little toy that falls over.
A weeble.
A weeble.
No, the weeble doesn't fall over. Weeble's the thing that looks like an egg.
It's like
you can't knock
it. It's like an anti-weeble then. It's
anti-weeble.
The anti-weeble. Honestly, I mean, it shows what, you know, how elite sports people are different to mere mortals. But it is astonishing that he carried on, that his mind was enough to think, I could still score and then I'll be injured. Because you could see it in his face, couldn't you? It was quite an amazing sort of moment, I thought.
Was he also uttering a silent scream because his face was distorted with pain? I didn't catch the scream, but he was in agony. And the shot was not like a little dribbly thing, the ball, you know, going 5 yards. It was a proper shot. That's extraordinary.
I remember, I think Dwayne Chambers once ran 100 metres and he didn't do so well. He went, I got cramp in both legs after 70 metres. And you think, shit, cramp in both legs. How are you running another 30 metres? Simon says, where on the Ramos scale of trophy dropping does Aubameyang fit? And Michael says, is this a good time, it's a great question, to address how poorly designed the FA Cup is? I know Aubameyang was meant to leave the base behind, but it always looks as though it's about to fall apart and the lid always falls off when it's lifted. Jonathan?
Well, I mean, the trophy, I think, was designed, about 110 years ago? And it doesn't seem to cause any problems till now. I mean, modern players can't cope with lifting a trophy, then... I mean, you need a detachable lid so that people like John Bailey can put it on their heads, or Tommy Doherty. You know, the magic of the cup...
And fill it with various alcoholic beverages as well.
Yeah, exactly. The magic of the cup has been diminished sufficiently without us taking off the putting a lid on a player's head.
I mean, in Russia, I think it was the league title trophy was handed over, and that was made of some sort of glass-type arrangement, and it was dropped and smashed by someone at Zenit St. Petersburg. So that was arguably more of a tragedy. But, I mean, if you're lifting the FA Cup, to get it so horribly wrong and drop it, oh, God. I mean, I'd like... Can we all pretend that didn't happen, put it back on the plinth and let me start again, please?
You can see why an Arsenal player wouldn't have been expecting it, though. They wouldn't have practised it. Jordan Henderson had clearly been practising trophy lifts for ages.
And one final thing, Philippe, is the implications for Spurs.
Yes, which is terrible, really sad. And Spurs will now have to go through the preliminary round of the Europa League.
It presumably starts about 3 weeks ago. Is that how it works?
But, yeah, how that's going to work, yes.
But at least Tottenham will have Troy Deeney by then. In I think Lars suggested this idea on the pod a week or so ago, and now it's the top football transfer rumour. And I, for one, am fully in favour of Deeney joining up with Jose Mourinho. I think it would be a total delight. Anyway, that will do.
And also, Wolves are no longer in the Europa League, which is another consequence of that.
Yeah, absolutely right. Although unless they win the Europa League and then they're in the Champions
League. In which case they will be in the Champions League, so they are no longer in the Europa League.
That'll do for part one. Part two will begin with Eddie Howe, who has left Bournemouth by mutual consent. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly with Barry Glendenning, Jonathan Wilson and Filippo Clare. So Eddie Howe has left Bournemouth by mutual consent. Ben Fisher writing in the paper yesterday. Survival against all the odds despite a 17-point deduction in League Two, leading a team wallowing in League One to the Championship 7 months after returning from Burnley. The pitch invasion after all but sealing promotion to the Premier League following victory against Bolton. From the top flight, they've... A mountain of memories to boot, dishing out bloody noses to Arsenal, Chelsea, Manchester United, perhaps most memorably Liverpool in 2016. We have short memories in football, Baz, but what Eddie Howe did at Bournemouth is pretty extraordinary, isn't it?
Yeah, he did a marvellous job, and it's a bit of a shame that it ended badly for him. I'm not surprised he left. I thought he really looked utterly miserable in the last few months at Bournemouth. I mean, just by his physical appearance, he always looks on the verge of tears, even at the best of times. But he really did look constantly on the verge of tears, and he struggled to hold it together when Bournemouth's fate was sealed on the final day of the season. There are people expressing their surprise that he left, and often when a manager and a club part company by mutual consent, the consent is generally more mutual on one party's side than the other. But I suspect that may not have been the case here. We don't know whether the club wanted him to stay or not, but I suspect the parting of the ways is probably for the best. You know, Eddie Howe, he has done a brilliant job there, but he's not without flaws. Some of his forays into the transfer market were a bit of a disaster. Bournemouth did have quite a high wage bill. They were by no means anywhere near the bottom of the table in terms of wages paid out to various players, a lot of whom did fail to deliver this season. Yeah, he gets to take some time out now and reset. We were talking to Harry Redknapp yesterday, and he said it's going to be tough for him because he lives in Bournemouth. His wife is a Bournemouth lass. He's spent so much time there, built a life there, but one presumes when he decides the time is right, probably when the axe starts falling on various Premier League managers next season, as it inevitably will, he will get offered another job. And it will be interesting to see how highly he's rated by, you know, will he get a job with a big club should one become available? I don't know if he will or not.
Well, William says, if Eddie Howe was a single in the top 40, how high had he got and what chart position is he in now? You know, down 24 to number 37. It's Eddie Howe. I hate to use a music analogy, Wilson, because you probably didn't understand what that meant. So I'll go to Philippe instead. Where was his stock at the highest, I guess, and where is it now?
I think it topped the indie charts, and definitely the promotion, that was definitely top of the indie charts. He had the follow-up singles were pretty good. But we're not quite, it was more like kind of an Undertones kind of thing. So it kicks off with Teenage Kicks, which is brilliant. You know, it's like indie hit, then it becomes a hit as well when it's re-released on a major label. Then he gets a few other hits, and then the hits start go, it's like top 20 goes to top 30, goes to top 40, and you think, you know. And then he does, you know, the last album, and then that's it. And then the band splits. And he has to join another supergroup, so or join the veteran circuit and share it with the Drifters and Spandau Ballet.
What you're saying is, when he was, you know, 10 years ago, when Eddie Howe was played on the chart show and the video went play, you were really excited. But now you want it to fast forward because you were like, oh, I've seen this one.
And the good bit sounded a bit, the hook sounded a bit the same. You know, this kind of thing. Sound of production was a bit the same too, a bit samey. And it's something I think we talked about a few times over the years here, is I always felt that Eddie Howe should have left the club much earlier for his own sake. And that I was wondering why it was that didn't happen, because what it achieved with the club was remarkable. Even if, as Barry rightly points out, Bournemouth were nowhere near a poor club when they were promoted. And remember, actually, they were fined quite heavily because they had breached financial fair play rules in their search for promotion. And they had accrued a lot of they spent a lot of money, basically. But what he did afterwards was quite remarkable. And the way in which he made his team play as well was quite remarkable. But you never, I always thought that there's a moment where he's got to go elsewhere. It's one of these things that can Bournemouth be anything but a springboard for a young manager like this? I don't know. And is it because there was the experience in Burnley, which was not a very happy one, you know, when he left Bournemouth for a few months and didn't really happen for him? And he thought, no, I'd better stay where I know I've got, I know everything there. I know the club inside out. I know I can do a good job there. And a friend of mine said, it's a bit like this parting of the ways is a bit like a couple which has been together for a long time and they were waiting for one proper incident to call it a day. And it felt a bit like that. But good luck to him. He's still very young and clearly very talented manager.
His next move is a pretty crucial one, I think, because it doesn't take long for a manager to go from being flavour of the month And, you know, it's not so long ago that he was spoken of as a potential successor to Arsene Wenger at Arsenal. And another manager who he actually cropped up in a David Squires cartoon about Leeds recently.
Monk?
No, Brian McDermott, who was also, during his time, was it at Reading or Swansea, was spoken as of a potential successor for Arsene Wenger. And reading the cartoon when I saw Brian McDermott, I was kind of thinking, where the hell, whatever happened to him? And I did a Google, and he basically seems to have disappeared off the face of the earth in 2016, and I've no idea what he's doing now. So if anyone knows, please.
He's on the space station. That's where Brian McDermott is. He's just floating about. He's his own satellite.
I hope he's okay, but yeah, if anyone knows where Brian McDermott is or what he's up to now, please let us know.
Newcastle United don't have as much money as some of their fans wanted them to have. The would-be Saudi buyers, part of the consortium, withdrew on Thursday, citing, among other reasons, delays in the Premier League's owners and directors test. Managing director Lee Charnley moved to reassure Newcastle supporters by claiming Ashley would back Steve Bruce in the transfer market and suggested hope of a restructured deal had not been abandoned. Whose reaction do we want? We want Philippe's reaction first.
I am not exactly surprised by what happened. There were doubts from very early on. The very fact that the deal or supposed deal was made public so early, and the media campaign which followed showed that at least one of the actors in that deal wanted the information to go out, which is very unusual for anybody who knows the way that the Saudis usually like to work, which is discreetly. And Mike Ashley is the same, by the way. And I think we had a case, a very interesting one, of something which was conducted through the media, which didn't reflect at all the reality of what was happening. What is extraordinary now is that we have a complete reversal of roles, and we're flipping the whole picture. And now it's all presented as being the result, the way that the takeover didn't take place, as the result of the horrible Premier League following the instructions from Qatar, and that the fact that piracy was a genuine problem, especially when the Premier League had condemned officially in two very strong statements the implication of Saudi Arabia in the piracy of beIN Sports. And I'm thinking we're seeing a very strange reversal. And also, by the way, the Premier League has not prevented PIF from buying the club. PIF got away. And the reason why they got away, I'm sorry, I don't quite buy them. It's all very complex, and I think we've been in a way fooled by the way it's been reported on for several months. And we've got to ask ourselves the question, why was it reported in such a way? Except, you know, on the podcast, we've talked about our doubts about this takeover from the very beginning.
Jonathan Liu wrote a piece, Wilson, saying that Newcastle fans, even the ones who are very upset that they haven't got the investment, and the ones who are quite naturally upset that Mike Ashley is still in charge of them, will realise in time that they've dodged a bullet. I presume you agree with that sentiment.
Yes, but I mean, it's sort of, it's two quite different bullets. And I thought, I mean, the other point that Johnny Liu raised in that piece, which I hadn't really considered, is the fall in the oil price and the general economic situation. I mean, clearly Saudi Arabia still have phenomenal amounts of money. They clearly still could afford this. But they have, I think, have they trebled VAT or something? But, you know, there is a sort of significant deficit there. So maybe there isn't quite as much spare capital as there had been. I think states should not own football clubs. I think it leads to all kinds of conflicts of interest, which are deeply unhealthy. So I think in sort of moral terms, Newcastle fans are, I don't know, even dodging a bullet. It's just, I accept my position is maybe slightly different to people who live in the area and who go every week. I'm in a privileged position as a fan that I go to maybe, you know, 8 to 10 Sunderland games a year. I'm not having to sit there and watch terrible, terrible football every week. I also haven't been ground down. And I'm talking about Sunderland, though, obviously. But I also recognise that Newcastle fans have been ground down by Mike Ashley, and that ownership situation is disgraceful. I can't see how you would want your club to be owned by a state like Saudi Arabia. I can't see how you would want your club associated with all the human rights abuses, with all the issues with misogyny and homophobia that go together in that package. I'd rather never win anything ever again than be associated with that. I just found it incredibly distasteful how people have been prepared to leave that to one side. But I actually also think they've dodged a bullet, and I don't think Mohammed bin Salman would have been a particularly good owner. I don't think anything he's ever done on the world stage suggests he's a kind of, he or the people he employs are particularly capable. He seems to me a pretty clumsy leader. So I don't think he would, even if you could leave him all stuff aside, I don't think he would have been adept at running a football club. And actually, I think the talk about, you know, hundreds of millions of pounds being available for transfers wouldn't have happened anyway, because FFP, although it is still pretty toothless, you know, even those gums can bite slightly. You can't just go out and spend £1 billion. People would actually raise a, you know, stink about that.
I'm puzzled that the Premier League haven't made a statement and don't appear to have any intention of making a statement, because at the moment we only have Amanda Staveley's word for what happened, and she's gone on a very calculated PR offensive blaming the nasty Premier League for stopping this consortium whose interests were purely humanitarian, who loved Newcastle so much, who wanted to pump so much money into regenerating the area, the poor deprived area of Newcastle, and all of which had the whiff of bullshit about it. So I would like to hear from the Premier League their reasons for delaying the decision to such an extent that the consortium pulled out, and I'd like to hear if they were provided with all the pertinent information they asked for as they mulled over making a decision.
Why should the Premier League say anything? It's not they didn't take a decision. If they had decided, oh, the people who are proposing to take the takeover are not fit and proper, yes, they would have to substantiate that. They didn't do anything of that kind. The Premier League actually didn't take a decision. And the reason why it didn't take a decision, so I'm told, is that there was a great lack of clarity about the ownership structure of this consortium. So who would be in charge of what? Who would be the chief executive? Who would be the president or chairperson or whatever? And apparently there was a great deal of lack of clarity for that. And also you add to that the fact that they had the WTO report. It's got nothing to do with Qatar, you know, or other clubs supposedly having put pressure on the PL to prevent them from taking a decision. The World Trade Organization report was not commissioned by Qatar. It was not commissioned by Liverpool Football Club. It was commissioned by the World Trade Organization and concluded that there were very strong links between the piracy of one of the Premier League's main clients in the world and the people who were the potential owners of a Premier League club. I mean, it seems to me quite obvious the Premier League had to be very careful about it. And perhaps, you know, instead of putting the any kind of culpability or guilt at their door and say, well, you should tell us. Well, no, I'm sorry. I would like to know more about this bloody takeover to start with. Who are they, these people? Who was supposed to take over? Why is it that the Rubin brothers only started to spoke on the day they pulled out? Why is it that we haven't heard a single word from the Saudis themselves? Not one.
About 20 years ago, I applied for a role at the Football Association management training. It was like a 3-year graduate scheme, and they would fast track you to become high up at the FA. And I got through to the final five, but in the team working part of the interview, the recruitment consultants noticed that I spoke too much and didn't listen to anybody else, and I didn't get through. But in a different world, you know, I would have climbed up the world of football administration. And I do wonder, whoever's running the Premier League, you know, people who love football, and sit there and go, why am I in the middle of some geopolitical battle between Qatar and Saudi Arabia? I just wanted to have a big trophy and shake hands with Brian Robson. You know, what's happened here? You know, I mean,
do you regret that rather than being the shit Tim Lovejoy, you could have been the shit Graham Kelly?
Well, do you know what? I would change everything to have at some point overseen the FA Cup third round draw in a tiny broom cupboard with Bert Milicic and Ted Croker. That would be the absolute dream. Suck out every single bit of possible excitement from that event. I would swap it all, Wilson, absolutely. While we're on football administrators. A criminal case against the FIFA president, Gianni Infantino, was opened on Thursday by a Swiss special prosecutor. The case is connected to a meeting Infantino had with the Swiss attorney general, who's since resigned, minutes before a federal court upheld allegations that he'd lied about a meeting with Infantino during an investigation into football corruption. FIFA said the FIFA president is subject to a criminal investigation by the Swiss judicial authorities, but he has not been charged, nor is he guilty of anything. FIFA and its president will continue to cooperate fully with the judicial authorities in Switzerland until these investigations are concluded.
Shocked.
Well, what I'm wondering is, I'm going to ask a Philippe a question, and I wonder if...
No.
if it's just bleeped out, listeners will realise why. What does this mean, Philippe?
It means that he's in a hot spot, and the first non-surprise is the fact that FIFA, the ethics committee, did not suspend Mr. Infantino when, for example, when Sepp Blatter and Michel Platini were the subject of a criminal investigation. They were immediately suspended 90 days. Now, if that happened in FIFA, it would be rather interesting to see what the consequences would be, because the person who would take the place temporarily, Gianni Infantino's place, would be no other than Sheikh Salman Al Khalifa, bin Khalifa, who is basically Infantino's enemy number one, the man he defeated to the presidency of FIFA in 2016, one of those. So it would be rather interesting. The thing is that it appears that this time the people who are driving this case do mean business, because it's not the first time that we've had those stories where FIFA people were on the wrong side of the law, or supposedly so, and that the Swiss justice ground so slowly that in fact we're still waiting for anything to happen, any trial or any verdict, any punishment, or indeed non-punishment. But in this particular case, the way it's been going at the moment seems to suggest that the Swiss justice is actually meaning business, and there are a number of people in Switzerland who have had really enough with all the skeletons which have been rattling in FIFA's cupboard for so long. And what was very interesting as well, FIFA issued an extraordinary press statement, the like of which I've never seen, never received before, which was a Q&A, a sort of with itself, in which they were trying to debunk and rebut what was happening. And the first, I will read the first paragraph of this rebuttal, which will, I think, instill you with a great deal of confidence in the way that FIFA is going about this business. So the question is, rhetorical question, what is FIFA's opinion on the opening of the proceeding by Dr. Stefan Keller? Answer: there was and is absolutely no reason to open any investigation, because nothing remotely criminal has happened and there is nothing at all to suggest any form of criminal wrongdoing. So you can see that a bit on the defensive here, and which is a new situation, because you wouldn't have had this press statement from Blatter's office, for example, when he was also in trouble. And it seems this case it's more serious.
I've very much been enjoying Blatter sort of stirring the pot from the sidelines.
Oh, it's beautiful.
Well, we had an interview with Blatter in the last Blizzard. I know you interviewed him a while ago, but Asasu interviewed him in the last Blizzard, and it was really his bitterness towards FIFA, I thought, was really interesting. I suspect we have a similar view of Blatter in that
just a good lad.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, to be honest, clearly self-serving. And clearly made a lot of money out of FIFA, but probably not actually corrupt.
It's a pity that we are Zooming this podcast at the moment. It's a pity that I didn't take a screen grab of Max's face when you said that and then published it.
Anyway, the skeleton's in the cupboard. We will, we're planning to open this cupboard a little bit, Philippe, aren't we?
And yes, we are.
We will dive into the cupboard and see if we're allowed out afterwards.
Rattle some bones.
Yeah, absolutely. In the meantime, we'll end part two and talk about FitBar. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. So the SPFL began at the weekend by stealth. Some people didn't even know it was happening. But Ewan Murray, our Scottish football correspondent, presumably did know it was happening and joins us now. Ewan, how are you?
Who didn't know it was happening? Where has this revelation come from? Who was unaware?
Well, maybe I'm speaking out of turn, but I certainly, when I looked at the fixtures and was like, what's happening here? Is this season ending or is this the season beginning? Are you speaking to us from the future? Are you surprised that it has started? Because I know there was all sorts of conversations about who would actually be in the division.
No, I'm not surprised it started. No, they always, because of their new television deal, they had the first weekend in August heavily pinpointed as when they were going to kick off. So no, I'm not surprised at all. They used that date. The circumstances by which they ended the last season is another thing, and I think I even bore myself with complaints about that. But they're off and running with a new one now, and everything seemed to go pretty well at the weekend, actually.
So now this has started. Is that the end of any kind of legal challenges from yes. Hearts or anyone else?
Yeah, that finished. There was an arbitration process which was finished last week. It was only days before the season started, actually. So that has been, I wouldn't say put to bed, that I wouldn't say resolved. In fact, far from it. But technically, yes, the season can get underway and did get underway as normal.
And before we talk about actual football, Ewan, how has Neil Doncaster come out of this sort of omnis shambles?
You're just trying to annoy me now, aren't you? You're winding me up with these questions.
him being, for anyone who doesn't know, the head of the Scottish Football League. He doesn't seem to have covered himself in glory, and I think I think it was you who pointed out in a recent-ish article that he earns more than any player in Scotland beyond those that big earners at Celtic and Rangers.
That's right. Yeah, I would imagine 95% of the players in Scotland. He earns £400,000 a year. I mean, for further context, Ladbrokes said last August they weren't going to continue their league sponsorship after last season. They haven't found, the league has no title sponsor. Scotland's national sport, the league does not have a title sponsor, which I would say is a pretty fundamental job of the chief executive of the league. And he hasn't found one. And he had months and months of this, even before COVID and everything that came with it. There are umpteen elements of Neil Doncaster's role in the end of the season that I would question. But I think possibly the worst was that he and the executive of the SPFL basically stood back as the clubs were really seriously warring amongst themselves, and I don't think that's good enough from a leadership. They stood back and let this happen under the auspices of, it's a members' organisation, we just do what the members are told, tell us to do, sorry. And I don't think that's good enough. I don't think their handling of the resolution to end the season was good enough, and I don't think Neil Doncaster's good enough at his job, bluntly, but I could spend all day talking about that. People argue I'm not good enough at my job, so I mean, it's I'm not preaching from some.
No one's ever said that about any of us. So, you know, I wonder how that feels. I couldn't possibly know. Is this season all about 10 in a row and Celtic, Ewan?
Unfortunately, yes. I wrote this at the weekend. It's the all-consuming narrative, and it was even before a ball was kicked. Can Celtic win the league, which I would fully expect them to do? Or can Rangers, who are realistically the only one team that could stop them, can they stop Celtic from making history? And that, you know, I find it sad that there is only, Celtic fans argue it's been a one-team league for years, which is correct, but my point is there's only one other team who can stop that one team from winning the league. So it's two teams that you're talking about in a success context. And I wish there was more teams. I wish it was possible we could speak about Aberdeen winning the league or Motherwell winning the league, but realistically that's not going to happen. So yes, it is all about 10 in a row.
I saw the Rangers match against Aberdeen on Saturday, and you're certainly right, Aberdeen won't be winning any leagues. They only lost 1-0, but as a fella I was watching it with commented, those lads couldn't pass the COVID virus to each other.
they were really poor.
Yeah.
They were alarmingly poor, Aberdeen, in that game. I mean, that's been a widely... It was hard to judge. Rangers fully deserved to win, and I think in the first half especially played reasonably well, but it was quite hard to judge Rangers' strength because the opposition was so meek, really. So, yeah, I fully agree with you about that.
We imagine Celtic should win the league, right? They've got the best players, they've got the most money, but what we really do want is a title race, even if it is just two sides, right? We want it to go to the wire. We want there to be an Old Firm on the last day of the season and the whole thing rides on it.
I think by the time the league was called last year, there was 13 points between the two teams. And nothing that's happened since would suggest that Rangers can be any closer to Celtic. I mean, Celtic haven't been meaningfully weakened and Rangers haven't meaningfully strengthened. Now, there's time yet in the transfer window and all sorts of things can happen. But I don't think there's evidence I think even a lot of Rangers fans would argue that, or point out, there's not a vast swathe of evidence which suggests they can win the league as we sit here just now. And again, things can change. Rangers' key ambition is to not do what they've done in the last two seasons, which is reasonably close up until January, and then their form just fell off a cliff and Celtic ended up being pretty comfortable.
And Celtic very comfortable on Sunday, weren't they, beating Hamilton Academical 5-1? And great delivery for the goals, actually, from the wide areas, I thought.
Yeah, the two fullbacks, Frimpong and Greg Taylor. I mean, Celtic have that advantage domestically where the fullbacks can play as kind of auxiliary forward players. I mean, they play so high up the pitch. And obviously, Odson Edouard, whose case is going to be interesting. I mean, as I wrote this morning, I don't think someone's going to buy Edouard because he scores a hat-trick against Hamilton. However, he's going to play over the coming weeks where other leagues aren't playing. There's going to be a lot of attention on him. And if he keeps scoring goals, he already has a lot of interest and admirers. But if he starts the season very, very well, I think it's inevitable that the interest in him is going to be stepped up a level. Speculation around him is certainly going to increase if he spends weeks that other major leagues aren't playing, scoring a lot of goals for Celtic.
There is talk this morning linking him with, hooking up with Brendan Rodgers again at Leicester.
Yeah, that's valid. Brendan Rodgers has retained admiration for him since he left there at Celtic and went to Leicester. That's a bit of an open secret. I mean, there's a few unknowns. The key one is whether Edouard wants to stay here and be involved in 10 in a row and regards that as a big deal, or whether he now thinks, you know, he's been here 3 years in total, including a loan. Whether he thinks that he's done enough in Scotland and he is worthy of a move by now, and also what level he thinks he can play at, and again the dynamics of this transfer window and the timing make it a lot of moving parts in this. PSG have a massive sell-on clause, so Celtic have to be offered a serious amount of money to have their heads turned, and they won't want to lose him. But you know, he's the best player in Scotland, he's the most valuable player in Scotland, and I just think the exposure he's going to get and benefit from over the next few weeks when the Premier League especially isn't playing is only going to increase speculation around him. And listen, he's a very good player. He deserves that. There's no slight on Celtic or anyone else.
What's happening below the SPFL in terms of when the season's all going to start again and also the future of the lower league clubs?
It will start on the 17th of October, I think I'm right in saying. 27 game seasons in the bottom three tiers. And as far as we know, these clubs are going to be okay. A lot of them operate below the championship, below the second tier, a very, very low staff number anyway. So staff have, you know, been furloughed, their staff have been released, and they can start back up. But having people in grounds at some point is going to be very, very important to these clubs because that's the business model by which they operate. So as things stand, they're all making confident noises that they can start in October and complete the season. But, you know, like a lot of things, if we get hit with a second wave or further restrictions come in, that would have a fundamental impact on the way these clubs can operate.
Richard says, if you had to pick an assistant referee to lead a political party, who would it be? This is Douglas Ross, the MP for Moray, is expected to be appointed the leader of the Scottish Conservatives. I mean, being the leader of a political party and an assistant referee, I mean, he must love getting abuse, right? I mean, yeah, that's amazing life choices that he's made. Is he a good lino?
It's not a very high bar there, Scottish officials.
Does he always keep to the right of it, the line?
This could go anywhere, couldn't it? Listen, I would, a completely non-political point, I can assure you, but I do admire him because I know the time and the training these guys have to put in to be officials at the Scottish Premiership level, which he has been. I mean, that's pretty demanding on top of serving his constituents, as I'm sure he does from Moray in the north of Scotland. So he's clearly a busy guy. I give him credit for that. But yes, he must enjoy the limelight, shall we say. It's two positions not a lot of people would take.
Finally, Ewan, Martin says, what are your thoughts on all three of Ross County's goalkeepers being called Ross?
Ah, yes.
Ross, this is Ross County boss Stuart Kettlewell last night welcomed Celtic keeper Ross Doohan and warned he faces a fight for the gloves. Doohan yesterday sealed a one-year loan move to the Staggies, where he'll compete with Ross Laidlaw and youngster Ross Munro for the number one spot. Are Ross County going to end the season with an entire team of Rosses?
I was trying to think what that's even similar to, and I can't come up with anything. Team names that are full of players. I couldn't come up with one when I saw that yesterday. That is a strange one and funny. They play Motherwell tonight and they haven't started the season yet, so we need to see how many Rosses are involved. They can't play their three goalies, obviously, but Ross Stewart, they have another, their centre forward is Ross Stewart. So
how many Keith play for Keith?
That's a good one too. I don't know enough about Highland League lineup to say that.
Well, listen, Ian, thanks for coming on. Appreciate your time, as always.
Chat to you through the season. Cheers, guys.
From Fitbar to Harrogate, they seal promotion to the Football League for the first time in their history with victory over Notts County at Wembley. Manager Simon Weaver described it as a dream come true, an unbelievable experience. When he answered an advert for the job in the non-league paper in 2009, the team's weekly wage bill was £1,600. 2 years later, his dad, Irving, the millionaire owner of Strata Homes, bought the club. It only turned professional in 2017-18, won promotion to the National League that year. Attendances rose from 200 10 years ago to around 1,500 this season. Simon Weaver is now the longest serving manager in all professional leagues. But they have to, they've got an artificial pitch. They've got to dig it up before the season starts on the 12th of September. Chantry B says, will rival teams and fans warm up at Betty's Tea Room next season? Now Harrogate Town are in the Football League. But before the pod, Jonathan, you were saying Harrogate, not as posh as everyone thinks.
No, it's sort of, it's one of these things that frustrates me. Everybody says, oh, it's a southern town in the north, by which they mean it's just quite nice. But it is a, you know, Friday, Saturday nights can get a bit tasty. It's not that nice. It is, however, it was the only English Eurovision venue not to have a league club. So it's good that it's got that. And it also has a Nightingale Hospital. So it's very much sort of at the cutting edge of modern British culture with a Nightingale Hospital and a league football club.
To Italy then. I know Nicky was on last week where pretty much all the big stuff was sorted. But Genoa survived, Lecce down. Ciro Immobile won the Golden Boot and the European Golden Shoe. Ronaldo didn't play in Juve's last game and they lost that. So eventually winning Serie A by just 1 point above Inter, but it was closer than that. So Juve, Inter, Atalanta and Lazio in next year's Champions League. Now, we're not doing a pod tomorrow. We're going to do it on Wednesday after Brentford v Fulham. Who's going up into the promised land in the most expensive, biggest, most important football match in the history of time every year? Barry?
Brentford. I think even I, who have no affiliation to them whatsoever, would be devastated if they blew three consecutive chances to go up in the space of a couple of weeks. So I want to see a new team in the Premier League.
Yes, I agree with you. Anyone supporting Fulham here?
Yeah, I do. I would be looking forward to going back to Craven Cottage, if such a thing will be possible, of course, given the circumstances. So as a pure neutral, I'd love Fulham to get into the Premier League.
Okay, and Wilson?
I think Brentford have played much more interesting football. And I've been doing a lot of my physio with some Brentford players, so I can exclusively reveal that the reserve goalkeeper Eloy Bascombe really loves Nando's to the point he would get it delivered to the gym, so he was waiting for him when he came out.
That is tremendous. Can we all welcome Wes Houlihan to Cambridge United? He flirted with us last summer, decided to go to Australia, and he's come back to the promised land. He is the most wonderful footballer, and I must admit, I didn't have much affiliation with him until he decided to put us on trial last summer. But now he's signed. I'm tremendously excited and feel that we'll win League Two. Nick Harris.
What has changed at Cambridge that turned his head this summer that wasn't there last summer?
I suspect no one in Australia offering him work is... It's my guess. Nick Harris, just back to the FA Cup final, saying, after so much televised football in such a short space of time, were ESPN in fact correct to show live bass fishing on Saturday on their main sports channel in the USA instead of the FA Cup final? Would you rather now, Barry, there's been a lot of football on. If you had to spend 2 hours watching either football match or bass fishing tonight, what would you choose?
Which football match would I be not watching?
Your choice is Sheffield United versus West Ham in the Premier League. And I'm saying...
Bass fishing. bass fishing. Even if no one catches a bass, I'm all in on the bass fishing. That is the biggest no-brainer you've ever asked me.
Well, I'm slightly confused by it because I saw somebody tweeting on Saturday that ESPN had not shown the Abide With Me bit. I didn't realise it then didn't show the rest of the game as well.
That's interesting because that's the most important part of the cup final that we didn't cover. That why was Emily Sande on the roof? What, who put her on the roof? Is she always on the roof? You know, where was there a meeting where they suddenly had to go to her agent and said, would Emily mind putting on a harness and going up to the roof of Wembley to sing Abide With Me? And someone saying, can't you just do it on the grass? And then saying, no, you have to do it on the corrugated iron.
I think Abide With Me is one of the best things about the cup final. I think it's... and I think particularly in context, it was actually very moving. I mean, it was odd. It was a two-phase process. It was the first phase of, what the fuck's Emily Sande doing on the roof? And then there was it's quite sad. And of course, Emily Sande is maybe the best person in the world to do it, partly because of her voice, but mainly because she was born in Sunderland and the epic was invented by Charles W. Alcock, who was born in Sunderland. So I'm glad to see the FA recognising its roots and giving the job to somebody very ably qualified for it.
They could have got a giant, say like a fishing reel and lowered her from the arch slowly as she sang Abide With Me.
I mean, if they'd cut then to Robson and Jerome to sing Up on the Roof, I don't think anybody wouldn't have been in favour of that. Okay then, let's finish the pod with Barry reading the words to Abide With Me. Thank you, Philippe, for your time. Much appreciated.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Cheers. Thank you.
Thank you, Barry.
You're welcome.
On Wednesday morning, me, Barry, Johnny Liu and Faker others will look back at Brentford versus Fulham. But now, as he clambers to the roof of his house in Brixton, it is Sunderland's finest, Barry Glendenning, with...
There is actually scaffolding up on the house next door, so I could technically get on the roof to read this if you really want me to. The only thing is I'm not very good with heights, so I might just stay in my office chair.
Barry Glendenning with Abide With Me.
Abide with me, fast falls the eventide. The darkness deepens, Lord, with me abide. When other helpers fall and comforts flee, help of the helpless, oh, abide with me. Swift to its close ebbs out life's little day. Earth's joys grow dim, its glories pass away. Change and decay in all around I see. O thou who changest not, abide with me. I fear no foe with thee at hand to bless. Ills have no weight and tears no bitterness. Where is death's sting? Where grave thy victory? I triumph still if thou abide with me. Hold thou thy cross before my closing eyes. Shine through the gloom and point me to the skies. Heaven's morning breaks and earth's vain shadows flee. In life, in death, O Lord, abide with me. Abide with me. Abide with me.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.